This is a talk from bethinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit bethinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a bethinker to hear all about bethinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. I would talk this morning on that third question, are all religions the same? You could also put it in the same form as the first two subjects. The first was, is Christianity an ideology? The second, is Christianity a projection? And the third, you could call also, is Christianity a religion? Years ago, one of the Beatles, George Harrison, produced this song, which has become very well known throughout the world. And it was called My Sweet Lord. I think you all know it. But the refrain that comes back again and again is, I really want to know you. I really want to see you, Lord. But it takes so long. And the choir that sings on the background sings first, Hallelujah. But halfway the song, this changes. Imperceptibly, the Hallelujah changes in Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna. And Hare Rama, Hare Vishnu, Hare Vishnu. And the whole pantheon of the Indian gods appear. Now I want to listen first to that song, and you try to catch it up. This song of George Harrison, when I heard it years ago, later on we had on the secondary school in which I was a teacher, there was a Christmas devotion, and then we gave the young people the opportunity to make up their own liturgy. And then one of the first songs on the program was this song of George Harrison, My Sweet Lord. And now, if you listen to him, you get at first certainly the impression that it's a Christian hymn in a modern form. But then suddenly, as you listen to the choir, you start to realize what he is doing. He starts with Hallelujah, but then the choir on the background changes. And suddenly it becomes Hare Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. And in this subtle way, he suddenly communicates a different message. And that is, are not basically Christ and Krishna the same? And that leads me to the question today, which you will face everywhere. The question, when it comes to the heart of the matter, all religions are the same, have the same content. It is, I think, because mass communication has opened our closed society to a world community in which we get to know Muslims and Buddhists, and they all seem respectable people. And secondly, the period, the end, we end today the period of colonialism. And the end of the period of colonialism has taken away the feeling of superiority of the white race over the other races. Or let's at least hope so. But at the same time, it took away the superiority of the religion of the white man, Christianity. In the meantime, all our Christian countries are under the influence of what we call secularization. So that the Christian faith has become empty in the inside, and in many churches it can be compared with a hollow tree. There have been theologians, I think of the German Bonhoeffer, who therefore have prophesied that we move in the West, meaning all the Western cultures, into a non-religious area. Now, this prophecy has certainly not been fulfilled because a remarkable thing happened. The last 10 years, while the theology expected a non-religious area, the last 10 years, suddenly you could even speak of a religious revival. The term is of Dr. Visser at Hoofd, who was the former president of the World Council of Churches, who observed that many more people than we ever had expected are interested in religion as such. I think that this is also true for Australia, but certainly it's true for the United States and Holland, where many young people today are involved in transcendent meditation or yoga or where we observe that the Jehovah Witnesses are going around and make disciples a lot, and the Mormons are doing good business, and the Baha'is and the Moonies and whatever groups there are. More and more people get an interest in cult. But, and that's the point where I want to talk about this morning, this whole interest in religion is almost always accompanied by that one powerful suggestion that George Harrison verbalized in his song, My Sweet Lord, and that is, are not basically all religions the same? Cannot they be compared with all the rivers of the world? And they are all different, of course, but at the end, they all stream in the same direction of the water of the ocean, in which they lose their water. And, secondly, is it not hypocrite to take Christianity out of the whole of the world of religions and to set that apart as the one true religion? Is it not just simply a sign of narrow-mindedness? The narrow-mindedness of someone who saw never someone else in the world. A sign even of intolerance or a rest of colonialism. Are not all religions the same when it comes to the heart of the matter? That is the problem. Now, answering the question, I want to follow the same method I did in the other lectures. And that is, first, moving back a little bit in history, who asked this question for the first time and in what kind of mentality, so that we know our own roots in this problem? Now, this George Harrison-type feeling may look like new or advanced, but it isn't. Because the question, are all religions basically not the same, came up in our culture. And again, I must talk about the time of the Enlightenment. It was in the time of the Enlightenment and in the mind of the philosophers of the Enlightenment, the 18th century, that this thought came up for the first time. Now, you expect me to talk about Feuerbach, but it was not Feuerbach, it was Lessing. The man who talked for the first time about this issue was called Lessing, L-E-S-S-I-N-G, Lessing. And he lived from 1729 to 1781 in Germany. He was a theologian, and he wrote a theater piece on the same question. And he called it Nathan the Wise. Maybe you have heard of it. It's published in 1779. The main theme of this play is to be found in the story of the three rings at the end of the second act, where a certain sultan, a Muslim, and a Jew, Nathan, meet one another. And they start to talk. And then Sultan Saladin, the Muslim, asks Nathan, the wise man from Jewish belief, he asks, what kind of religion do you consider to be the best? And then Nathan answers the question after having thought by telling a parable, as Jews do. In days long past, he said, there lived in the East a man who possessed a very precious ring with a splendid opal. And this ring had a special virtue. The person who wore the ring was in favor with God and man. Now, it stands to reason that in his last will and testament, this man enjoined his descendants never to part with this ring. So each man who possessed this ring gave it on his deathbed to his eldest son, or his favorite son. But now, in the succession of the generation, as the ring was handed over from generation to generation, it happened to be that there was one time a father who had this ring on his finger, but he loved his three sons in an equal measure. And during his life, he had promised the ring to each one of them. But none of them knew that his two brothers had been given the same promise. Now, when his father felt that his end was drawing near, and that he was in duty bound to give his sons the promised ring, he tried to avoid the difficulty he had raised himself by ordering a goldsmith to make two other rings, exactly like the original ring. And when the work had been finished, nobody, not even the father, could make out which of these rings was the original, the true ring. And when he died, the father gave each of his son one of these rings. In each case, the other two sons did not know about this gift. When the father had died, each of his three sons claimed that he possessed the true ring. And nobody could say who was right. And so Nathan said to the Sultan Saladin, similarly, we cannot make out which is the true religion. But Sultan Saladin reacted by saying, no, you're joking. I think that these three religions, Mohammedanism, Jewish religion, Christianity, that it can be distinguished in many things, in matters of dress and food and drink and liturgy and so on. No, said Nathan, not essentially, not in fundamental matters. Are they not all based on records and on oral tradition? And each of us believe what his parents told him. And each of us puts his trust in other people who proved their faith by deeds of love. Why should I consider my ancestors less trustworthy than you do yours? And the same holds good for Christians, don't you think so? And Saladin granted that Nathan was right. And he did not know what to say next. But then Nathan continued his story by telling that the three sons, being confused about all of them having the official ring, went to a judge. And they asked this judge to make a decision on this problem. And each of the sons swore that he had received his ring from his father himself and that he was rather inclined to distrust his two brothers than his father. And what about the judge? Said Saladin. I wonder what he's going to say. And then Nathan told him what the judge summed up. He said, of course, only the judge. He said, of course, only your father could tell the truth. But he's dead. Or the ring could speak itself. But the ring doesn't speak. But wait a minute. You told me that the wearer of the true ring will be in favor with God and man, and full of love, because the ring possesses a magic power. This enables us to settle the matter. The ring which lacks this power is spurious, is the wrong ring. So my judgment is as follows. For the time being, accept matters as they are. As your ring was given you by your father, take it to be the genuine ring. And let each one of you exert himself to the utmost to prove that his ring is the right one by love, by benevolence, by tolerance, by spiritual sacrifice to God. If thus the virtue of your ring becomes apparent among your descendants, I will summon you again before the judgment seat after 1,000 years have passed. You can go now. And that is the whole story of the three rings. So what did Lessing now convey by this? Two things. At first, he brought in a tremendous relativity. No one knows whether he possesses the true ring. He did not deny that truth was there, but he said, no one can know it. That's typically, again, for the culture of the Enlightenment and the whole mentality that came out of this. What we always have stressed in these days, the loss of truth. At least, if there is truth, you can't know what it is. You can't know it. But secondly, he made very clear in this picture what he felt to be the heart of each religion by the judgment of the church. Because the heart of all religions, said Lessing, is what the judge at the end of the story communicated. And that was, God will reward an honest man, a virtuous man, by giving him the crown of immortality at the end of his life on earth, if he has lived a virtuous life. This is what Lessing himself felt to be the heart of the matter. Just like Kant and Goethe, his contemporaries, Lessing thought that the substance of Christianity consists in three ideas: God, virtue, and immortality. He found that as being the same substance in Mohammedanism, Jewish religion, and in Christianity. And therefore he said, let's stop the question, which of the religions is the true one? Because every religion is basically good, but wear your own ring. Wear your own ring. Try to be in favor of God and man, says the judge. Let Jewish people profess their Jewish religion, and Muslims the Islam, and Hindus Hinduism, and Christians Christianity. Let everyone practice his own virtue, and by doing this, he will be loved by God and man. Now, the problem is, in this description by Lessing of what is the heart of all religions, we receive a definition of the heart also of Christianity, in which we do not recognize ourselves. And here I come to the real problem. This description of the center of all religions is God, virtue, be a virtuous man, and then you will receive immortality. Is that the heart of all religions? Is that the heart of Christianity? I think it tells us a lot about Lessing and about what the thinkers of the Enlightenment thought to be the center of all religions. But the problem is that it is not the heart of Christianity. And we touch here the basic problem in Lessing's position, and with him in the position of all those people today who say, are not religions all basically the same? As soon as someone is saying all religions are the same, you should reply with a counter question. You have to, because if someone is saying, all religions are the same, what do you say? You answer with a counter question and you say, but can you tell me what is that sameness? What is then that reality that all religions have in common? And immediately you are drowned in the problem. I can say it to you before. Why? Because no one gives the same answer. Try it. No one will give the same answer. Lessing, when answering this question, said, the center of all religion is God, virtue, and immortality. There is a God, live a virtuous life, and you will receive as a reward immortality. But the problem is, that is not the heart of Christianity. Because this is exactly, you could say, it's the heart of Jewish legalism. I think it's the religion of the Pharisees in the New Testament. God, live a virtuous life, you will be rewarded by God. But it's a religion that Jesus rejected and opposed. Okay, you can say, yeah, Lessing made the wrong decision. So he's maybe a little bit old-fashioned scholar. Today we have sharper guys, and maybe we'll find better answers today. I tried. I really tried to find out what those who are working on this field have said that all religions have in common. And I've studied a lot of them. And I'll give some examples of the most well-known ones. At first, well-known scholar is Rudolf Otto. And Rudolf Otto said, the center of all religions is awe for the mystery. Awe for the mystery. That's the center of all religions. When you listen to Schleiermacher, another theologian of the last century, he said, the heart of all religions is a sense of dependence, a sense of dependence from an all-embracing power. The sense of dependence, that's the heart of the matter. Very well known in this field today is the writer Hermann Hesse. Now, if you would ask Hermann Hesse, who holds this statement, that all religions are the same, and he wrote a lot of books, when you would ask Hermann Hesse what he felt to be the center of all religions, then he would answer, finally, it all comes down to the experience of oneness with the totality of being. That's what he felt to be the center of all religions. It's the experience of oneness with the totality of being. But other thinkers have other answers. For instance, today you feel there are a lot of thinkers on the level of religion, like the Dutch theologian Kuytert, who have other type of answers. Kuytert said, each real religion is an attempt to provide man with a system of orientation according which he wants to change the world. Each religion provides a man with a system of orientation according which he wants to change the world. But it's clear that this definition is defined by Marxism. It's influenced by Marxism. Because in Marxism, as we saw in the first lecture, religion is in a way a map that must help man to find his practical goal. But anyhow, these examples, and I could give more, when you study them, you come to the sudden awareness that no one is giving the same answer, and you are left behind confused. Whoever you ask to give a description of what is the center of all religions, they all come up with different answers. And when people succeed to find an answer that is true for all, then it's such a general statement that you feel it doesn't express anything at all anymore. Because, of course, you could come with, for instance, a general statement that all religions deal with man in his relationship to the absolute, or something like that. When you formulate it that wide, then indeed you can cover something. But then you realize it expresses nothing at all anymore. And that means that the ideal of the Enlightenment, and that was to create a reasonable religion on the basis of man's autonomous reason. That's the ideal of the whole Enlightenment, to control reality with the mind of man. That ideal, to create a reasonable religion, that attempt has failed. It's another attempt of man to even control God with his mind. But it failed. I must think here again and again of the well-known expression of old bachelors, that knowing that they were unable to have a long-term relationship with any woman, they have big words among one another in their bachelor's club, saying, "You know, all women are the same anyhow." Then you wonder whether they really know women. As long as you do not know them, you can hold that statement. They are all the same. But the whole thing changes as soon as you get to know them. Now that leads me to the second point of my lecture. And that is, what is then the center of Christianity? If we do not recognize ourselves in neither the definition of Lessing, nor the one of Otto, nor the one of Kuytert or Hermann Hesse, because I feel not recognized when I read them. I say, what is now the center of my faith? And then I compare it with their definitions, and I say, no, the center of my faith was left out. So it throws me back on myself, and I think we all should try to say that. What is now the center of our faith as Christians? It's always harder to verbalize it than you think, but let's try. Because we cannot solve the question whether all religions are the same when we haven't just at first verbalized what the heart is of Christianity. Once we have phrased that, we can look around and we can see whether other religions have the same. That's an honest attempt. So we come now to the second point. What is the center of the Christian faith? Is it a fascinating view on God? Is it a very highly developed morality, ethics? Is it the emphasis on the uniqueness of man? I think that all of these questions have some truth in them. But nevertheless, they do not touch the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter of Christianity can be found in one word which we meet on almost each page of the New Testament. And that is the name after which Christians, especially outside Holland, are called, and that is evangelicals. And that's the word evangel. Evangel or gospel, it's the same word. Or translated, it's just good news. I think in this word we touch the heart of Christianity. Christianity is not built on the teaching of a prophet like Mohammedanism, or in quite another way, the Jewish religion. Think of Moses. It's not built on deep meditation like Buddhism. It's not built on a fascinating philosophy like the Anthroposophy, for instance. It's built on a message. It's built on that one word, message, good news, evangel, or in Greek, kerygma, that means gospel. The apostles were neither prophets nor philosophers. But they were messengers, they were heralds. That was the real being. And all these New Testamentic words, gospel, evangel, message, refer to a terminology which was in the time of the New Testament secular. We should realize it. For us, the word evangel immediately makes us thinking of the pulpit. But in that time, the word evangel was a secular word. In the same way, like today, the evening news. We should use words like that. Only in the time of the New Testament, there was no radio, no television. So therefore, they had other means of communication, of communicating the news. Now, how did they communicate the news? They did this by sending messengers, heralds. And especially in time of war, these messengers were tremendously important. Now, we should, for a moment, try to understand what this word and the background of it really meant. Imagine we would have lived in that time in a little city in, let us say, the Roman Empire. Small city, and we would know that barbarians had invaded the country. We would know that. But on the other side, we would know that the emperor had come with his army to fight them. You can imagine how we would put our waiters on the wall of the city to watch over the fields to know, because we knew that the battle was going on, what the outcome would be. So the waiters are waiting and look over the fields until they see a messenger coming, a herald on a horse. And the whole number of citizens of the city come together on the marketplace, and the herald comes in with his horse and running in, and then you can imagine the tension, in what kind of a hunger the people looked up for the news, because they would know if this man would say we've lost there, they would have known the barbarians would come and would kill their wives and children or take them away as slaves. But they would know the opposite too. They would know if he would say we won the battle, they would know that life would be restored. Now, this is the social-political background of the word evangel. And then imagining that this messenger comes in and he's raising his thumb and he's saying, we've won the battle. What a kind of an effect this has on the crowd. Now, that is the true content of the word evangel or good tidings. That is now exactly what the apostles were doing when they went out. They didn't come and brought a profound philosophy or were moral teachers or meditating Buddhists or something like that. They were messengers. Christianity is not primarily good views, but good news. And that's the first point I want to make very clear, because that's the heart of the matter. It is good news about the victory that someone else has wrought in space, time, and history, of which my life here and now completely depends. That is Christianity. And that's how the Bible looks to our human existence. I would like to keep up a moment that picture of an empire under the dominion of intruders, invaders, alien powers under the leadership of the King of Darkness. And each man, wherever he lives or whoever he is under the control of these powers of darkness. The Bible calls them sin and death. But the Bible tells us also the other side, and that's the emperor has not left us alone. He has himself raged the war, and he has won the battle against the prince of darkness, against the intruder. Now, that is the whole meaning of the work of Christ on the cross on Calvary. And his victory is proclaimed by messengers, heralds. In the heart of Christianity is this message. Something has happened there and then that completely changed the whole existence of me here and now. We are no longer a slave of death and sin and of the powers of darkness, but we are free through Christ. And that's what we may pass on to one another. That's what I pass on now to you. And we may pass it on to one another and to all people that should hear it. The battle is won. We should put up our thumb and say, the battle is won. The enemy is lost. And therefore you are free. You are free from the powers of darkness through Jesus Christ. Now that's the heart of Christianity. If you cut that out, you can get the rest from me. I mean it. Then the rest you can get. That's the heart of the matter. From this center flows a completely different teaching on the way of salvation. That's the second point I would like to talk about. The second point is, when we talk about Christianity, then we should compare this point with all the other religions. Now, all religions outside Christianity teaches a way of salvation, how man can be saved, and in a way Christianity does too. But all the other religions say, when you want to be saved, you have to do something. You have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do that. And then maybe, at the end, you will have eternal life. That is what they teach. It is as if they teach men to climb from beneath upon the ladder upwards. The Jews have to observe the law. It's a caricature of the Old Testament, but that's what they teach. You have to observe the law. To the Muslim, it's the obedience of the five religious duties that they have to pursue that brings you to God. The Buddhists teach you the Eightfold Path, as they call it. But it's always how I, as a man, from underneath, can and must climb up to God. Now, the Christian good news turns the ladder opposite around. Turns this way of salvation around. It's not longer how I, by a long way, think of that song of George Harrison, because it always touches me when he's singing that, because of a kind of sincerity in it, and also because it is one sentence, but it takes so long. He had been in India. It took a long, it takes a long time. Now, it's no, but in Christianity, and hearing the good news, it is no longer, it takes so long before we can reach God, but it's the joyful message how God, by a long and painful way, has reached us. And the center of the Bible, as you all know, is John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he sent us his Son. He came to us, the opposite around. And his victory has been wrought outside of me. It has been wrought without my help, far away from me, on the edge of the empire, you could say. Not in Rome, and also not in Athens, but on a hill outside Jerusalem. There the victory has won, and there the origin is of a message that has changed my life. And I do not need to do anything to share in this salvation. That is the most beautiful part of Christianity. I must simply let it be true. That's all. Under the Christian message, no one needs to do anything, but just simply accept that it has been done for him. Raising the empty hands of faith. That is the heart of Christianity. Now that's the second point I want to mention. First, the unique proclamation. That was the first thing we saw. Secondly is the unique way of salvation. Salvation through grace, through faith alone. The heart of the Reformation, justification by faith. And then in the third place, and at last, this leads me automatically to a completely different concept of God. The God of the Bible is not the impersonal, all-embracing energy that people worship in the East. Infinite, that's true, but their God is also impersonal. But the God of the Bible is, as we understand out of this good news, is a very personal God. It is our king, it's our emperor, who didn't want to lose us under the power of darkness, but who came and who worked out victory for us. The God of the Bible is not a severe judge of the Jews, who first wants obedience and then he gives love, but who loves first and then asks obedience. And it's also not the immovable, all-ruling, all-determinating Allah of the Muslims. But it's a God full of compassion and committed to his children in such a way that he even is willing to give up his son, his own life in a way for us. The whole concept of a personal, infinite God of the Bible, the king who won the victory, it just flows forward from the central word, the good news, the proclamation of the good news. Now, that are the three points I wanted to make. Center of Christianity, a unique proclamation, a unique way of salvation, and a unique disclosure of God. Of course, this is all centered in the person of Christ. Dr. Friso Meltzer, a well-known German missionary, has once in a public debate, he has been talking in India with a Hindu, and they discussed the theme of this morning together. Are not basically all religions the same? And whatever he said as a Christian, it was always answered by the Hindu with agreement. Agreement and a statement. But teachings like that are also present in Hinduism. And whatever he said, it was always also present in Hinduism. And at the end, he got upset. And he said bluntly, but what about Jesus Christ? And then for the first time, the Hindu said, yes, you're all right. We do not have him. Now that leads exactly to the central point, because the whole teaching of Christianity flows as a river in a different stream and in another direction from him as a person. Center of Christianity is in fact a person, and not a philosophy or meditation or morality. I liked always very much the story I heard from a Dutchman who traveled through India, a certain man called A. Pos. And he told, one time I came in the house of a Hindu and I saw two pictures. On the one picture I saw Krishna caressing and playing love with his Radha, his beloved, hanging in a swing and searching for lust. And on the other picture I saw Jesus on the cross, dying in agony and in love for our salvation. And underneath both of the two pictures, someone cynically wrote the sentence, both are hanging. And the missionary said, I never saw so clearly suddenly the chasm between Krishna on one side and Christ on the other side. Now, why did I take so much time to concentrate on the center of Christianity? Because I think that we can now start to give an answer on the question whether all religions are the same. Because all the characteristics of Christianity hang together with this central message of the Bible. I even dare to defend the statement that because this, in a way, secular message, which is the heart of Christianity, that in a way it's a secular message. It was not meant to be a religious, deep thought, but it is a historic, secular message that the disciples brought around. Something that really happened there in Jerusalem at that time. Because of the fact that this is the heart of Christianity, it makes it very hard for me to believe that Christianity is a religion, to be honest. I don't think it's ever meant to be a religion. Imagine someone comes in at the moment on the Falkland Islands, and I am a family, I've closed myself up in my house, I'm one of the inhabitants of the Falkland Islands, because we are invaded by the Argentine enemy. And then someone comes to my home, and he gives me the message, the British troops have landed, and we are free again. Imagine that I get this message, and I take a book, and I write it with golden letters in a beautiful book. And I make a cult of it. Now, this would be ridiculous. Now, in the same way, the message that something has happened there, and then to deliver you from those things that threaten the human existence. In the same way, that message is never meant to be written with golden letters in a book and to be cultivated. It should be taken worldly, as it's meant to be. And it should create a tremendous joy. And we should act upon it from now on, in a new life and under a new king. Now, that is Christianity. And now I know that I've simplified a little bit, because of course the messenger of the good news, they need the help of written proclamations, and it is good to handle over their message to the next generation, and that takes time. And of course the new king must be worshipped, and all kinds of religious attitudes and behavior comes in around worship and around liturgy, and that's all good. But basically, essentially, coming down to the heart of the matter, Christianity is not a religion. It's not a religion at all. It's just good news about the real world in which I live, about God's work of salvation in space, time, and history. That is Christianity. Now I come finally, that's the third and last part of my lecture, I come to the question to understand the deep difference between the Christian faith and the world of religions. Because now that I've defined what the essence is of Christianity, I look back. I look back to the other religions. I turn back and I ask the question, but how should then a Christian, on the basis of this unique knowledge of God, evaluate the other religions? How should I look to the other religions? Are all other religions just idolatry, meaningless lies, just product of the corruptness of man, nothingness? There have been times that Christians took that position. I can quote already from the early church how a man like Tertullian, you've never heard of him, but believe it, that a man like Tertullian said, what has Athens in common with Jerusalem? Nothing. You see what he's doing? means it's Christianity and all the rest is lies, nothing but lies. Is that the valid position? Now, to answer that, we have to turn back to the Bible itself. And the first remarkable discovery in the Bible is the emphasis in the Bible on the worldwide general revelation of God, the Creator. And God the Creator is the same God as the God of Israel and of the Father of Jesus Christ. We should never forget that. And the whole Bible emphasizes the fact that He is not just the God of one nation or of one group of people, but that, we read in Romans 1, verse 20, ever since the creation of the world, His invisible nature, namely His eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made, and that reveal God as the God of the whole of creation and of the whole of mankind. And that is universally true. I think now of Psalm 19, and things like this have been emphasized the whole week. So that Paul can even say in Acts 14, verse 15, 16, and 17, he talks to pagan people, and then he is saying, we also are men of like nature with you, and we just bring you good news. He has the word. We just bring you good news, he's saying to them, that you should turn from these vain things, because they were worshipping an idol, that you should turn from these vain things to a living God, who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. And then he adds, and therefore I quoted it, in past generations, God allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways. Yet he did not leave himself without witness. Yet he did not leave himself without witness. For he did good, and he gave you from heaven rains and fruitful seasons, satisfying your heart with food and with gladness. But that point, he did not leave himself without witness. Did God give them the saving knowledge of the good news right from heaven? The center of Christianity? No, otherwise Paul wouldn't have been there. Would have been no necessity that Paul would be there. But he brought them, the Lord gave them the message, no, Paul gave them the message of a God whom they had already some awareness of by other means. They had already an awareness of him by other means, and that is nature, the voice of the inner conscience, and remarkable events that gave them already before the awareness of his presence. Paul is saying in Acts 17, verse 23, to the Greeks, when he preached the gospel to them, then he started to say, the God whom you unknowingly serve, I proclaim to you. Very profound thing. The God whom you unknowingly serve, I proclaim to you. It's true, the Bible is indeed saying that knowledge by nature, by the inner conscience, by remarkable events, and so on, that this knowledge is repressed. Romans 1, verse 20, it's repressed knowledge. But no one can deny that it is the repression of true knowledge. The non-Christian religions are the human answer on this general revelation of God, and that's my definition. The non-Christian religions are the human answer on the general revelation of God, with emphasis on all aspects in this definition. There is truth underneath. When the Chinese religions observe a unity in the creation, a oneness between the microcosmos and the microcosmos, the macro and the microcosmos, which receives its expression in the book I Ching, then they have found an awareness of truth. They have found truth. Truth about the creative, universal power of God that we maybe have lost. When Indians express the need of silence and wordlessness, and they express the need of silence and wordlessness before the tremendous mystery of the unknown, they have grasped something that we maybe because of too great familiarity have lost. If they already, with their suppressed knowledge of God, have that all, how much more should we? That's, I think, how we should think of it. When Africans express a sense of awareness of an unseen world around them, a world of spirits and of power, they are closer to the truth than a secularized man. But all the moments of truth in their religions do not hide the fact that there is no saving knowledge, because they do not have the good news. Their religions remain fully, as I said, a human answer, with all the ambiguity of it, of man's greatness on one side and of man's wickedness on the other side. It's a human answer on God's revelation, general revelation. It has become, their religion has become a totality of expressions and feelings and cults in which descendants of Adam and Eve have tried to evade the God to whom they did not really want to turn back. That is the fact, the background, the biblical view on all other religions. But what always strikes me in reading the Bible on this, that are the many people in the, that the Bible talks about who knew God outside the circle of the covenant. You can think in the Old Testament of Melchizedek, of Job. Job was a man outside the covenant. Of Abimelech, of Jethro. All these names are difficult for me to pronounce. Nebuchadnezzar is another one, hard to pronounce. Paul, the Lord said to Paul in Acts 18, before he preached the gospel to that city, in Acts 18, verse 9, he said, I have many people in this city. Also such a remarkable statement. I have many people in this city. Now, I conclude out of this that that God, the Creator, has a history with each man and with any culture and with all the nations. And therefore, this should prevent us to make too quickly statements about how God condemns all people whom we hardly know. Sometimes there is this judgmental atmosphere in Christianity where Jerem talked about this morning. The God of the Bible, and I want to end with that sentence, the God of the Bible is the God of the universe, of the whole of his creation, and he is much wider at work than we realize or are aware of. There are great mysteries behind God's dealings with the nations. The saving knowledge of God comes only through the good tidings. Let's make that very clear. The saving knowledge of God comes only through the gospel of Jesus Christ. But a repressed knowledge of the Lord makes it possible to say sometimes to people, I proclaim to you the God whom you unknowingly serve. That's where I want to end the last point of my lecture on Are All Religions the Same?